Hello and welcome to Yesterday's News, the podcast that brings you the biggest stories from this week in history. I'm Joe Forrester and I'll be guiding you through the historical headlines from the earth-shattering to the absurd. And my guest this week is presenter Neil Reynolds. Remember, you can follow the show at Very Old News and please do get involved. No tweet is too trivial for our attention. On with the show. First up, we're in Hawaii as Japan declares war on America. Next, we're in San Francisco as the free love of the 60s comes to an end with violence. And finally, we're in 50s London as we try and see our way through a very foggy health hazard. First up, it's the 7th of December 1941, and we have breaking news from the Hawaiian island of Oahu, where the US naval fleet in the Pacific is under attack. Neil Reynolds is live on the scene.
That's right, Joe. We were awoken at 7:55 this morning as 360 Japanese warplanes descended on the naval base here. We now know that 5 of 8 battleships, 3 destroyers and 7 other ships were sunk or severely damaged, and more than 200 aircraft were destroyed and casualty figures are ever rising. I still don't know the reaction in the US, but Joe, we have to believe this will mean war.
The very next day, US President Franklin Roosevelt had this to say.
Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation. The Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, no matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion. The American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. We will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
As the dust settled on the Pearl Harbor attack, it became clear that 2,400 Americans had been killed and a further 1,200 injured in the single largest attack by a foreign enemy on the US to date, something that would stand until September 11th, 2001. Despite what appeared to be a stunningly successful surprise attack, the Japanese had actually failed in their objective of destroying the three enormous aircraft carriers that would cripple US power in the Pacific, as all three, contrary to intelligence, were actually out to sea. With hindsight, Japan's actions may seem confusing. Why bring the world's largest industrial power into the Second World War? Well, tensions between the two nations had intensified throughout the 1930s, with the US proving a major obstacle to Japan's imperial ambitions, and culminating when President Roosevelt placed an oil embargo on the Japanese, spurring them on to desperate action in order to save their economy. Bizarrely, on the 11th of December 1941, Hitler then declared war on the US. Now, of course, he was supporting his Axis ally Japan, but by no means did he need to provoke the Americans. He is reported as being relieved after Pearl Harbor, believing the US would now stop covertly helping the British and would instead focus on the war in the Pacific, leaving him free to defeat Britain in the West. He was very, very wrong. Churchill had a better handle on the situation, and despite being horrified, said that night he
slept the sleep of the saved and thankful.
He knew American entry into the war meant the Allies could not lose. Hitler now not only found himself contending with the Soviets in the East and the British in North Africa, but America's industrial might and sheer manpower meant the Allies were able to invade Western Europe in the D-Day landings of June 1944, while the Japanese could simply not compete with America's overwhelming resources. When they refused to surrender despite being very obviously beaten in August 1945, the war in the East came to an end when atomic bombs were dropped on the cities of Hiroshima, then Nagasaki. 400,000 Americans died in the Second World War, and after the shock and horror that followed the Pearl Harbor attack, their entry into the conflict irrevocably turned the tide in the Allies' favour. Next up is the 6th of December 1969, and we go live to Altamont, California, where a concert meant to promote free love has descended into violence. The Rolling Stones are live on stage as a fight has broken out, and lead singer Mick Jagger is addressing the audience.
Splitting, you know, if those cats cut, if you people, we're splitting, man, if those cats don't stop beating everybody up inside. I want them out of the way, man. I don't like you.
That guy's got a gun out there and he's shooting at the stage.
The Altamont Festival was to be the West Coast answer to the legendary Woodstock Festival. However, had nowhere near the organisation that Woodstock did, and when the Hell's Angels were drafted in to provide security in exchange for $500 worth of beer, trouble was inevitable. The biker gang clashed with spectators, and Jefferson Airplane singer Marty Balin was knocked out during a confrontation, causing the Grateful Dead to pull out at the last minute. The concert was headlined by the Rolling Stones, whose brainchild the show was. However, during their performance of Under the Thumb, a serious scuffle erupted and 18-year-old Meredith Hunter was stabbed to death by a Hell's Angel. There were three other accidental deaths at the concert, as well as, bizarrely, four births. However, most significantly, the violence and anger of the day signalled a shocking end to the hopeful love of the 1960s. And finally, we're in London on the 4th of December 1952, as a deadly fog is enveloping the city. Neil Reynolds has been joined by meteorologist Joe Forrester to tell us more.
Mr. Forrester, tell us how the fog has impacted you.
Well, first, you notice we can't see a bloody thing, Neil, and it's all because of coal. This city burns coal as its main fuel source, and that, mixed with a lack of wind and anti-cyclone conditions, has meant that airborne pollutants have gathered, creating this pea super.
I see. Is it dangerous?
Yes. Not only does it make travel hazardous, but people are dying, as this smog is even able to penetrate indoor areas.
Back to you, Joe.
Thanks, Neil. Yes, the smog, which lasted between the 4th and 9th of December, is estimated to have killed 4,000 people, and over 100,000 others became ill because of it. Recent research has even put the number of fatalities at closer to 12,000. London had suffered from appalling air quality for centuries, but the Great Fog of 1952 was the worst incident of pollution in British history and resulted in the Clean Air Act of 1956, which reduced pollutants and encouraged the use of smokeless fuels. The Act represented an important first step on the road to the environmentally conscious government of today. So there you have it. With me to discuss today's stories is presenter Neil Reynolds. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How are you? I've got a very squeaky chair. Sorry, mate. How are you?
No, I'm good, thanks.
History.
History.
Let's talk about history.
Bring it on.
Is history something you're interested in?
I'm going to give my age away now, but I got an A in O-level history.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
Social and economic history from 1740 to 1970. It was Todpoddle Martyrs Pitt the Younger we went through.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, it was everything. Absolutely everything.
Todpoddle Martyrs, Pitt the Younger's, presumably stuff like Peterloo, Disraeli,
yes,
Gladstone,
yeah, absolutely,
all that sort of stuff. Now, here's a funny thing, right? And I was chatting to someone about this quite recently. You got an A.
Yes.
So well done.
Thank you.
But one of the things that I think, and lots of the guests I have on here certainly didn't get an A in history.
Okay.
Most people text me sort of when I say, oh, do you want to come on the show? I don't know nothing about history. And I go, that's fine, because you're here to sort of, I don't assume any prior knowledge. But why at school do they choose to teach? Now, I don't think any period of history is dull if it's taught correctly. Mm. But why do they choose to teach, quite frankly, what I consider to be a boring period?
Well, I think what they were trying to teach us was all about the Industrial Revolution.
Mm. That doesn't lend itself to excitement.
Well, it doesn't really, no. But I'm old. So back then, it probably was exciting. Mm. Because I'll tell you now, I'm 50 next year, and I've lived through a lot of history. So do you see, in 30 years' time, do you potentially see C-3PO as kind of a form of AI, and that's the kind of history that our kids are going to be talking about?
Oh, now, essentially, Stephen Hawking thinks artificial intelligence is a dangerous thing because, reduced very simply so people like I can understand it, Terminator 2 is possible in the sense that the natural conclusion is if you create something with intelligence and it becomes self-aware, even if it adheres to Alan Turing's principles that you can never harm a human being, then by its very nature, and this happens in iRobot as well, then they will decide, well, the way to protect human beings from harm is to eliminate or enslave human beings, because we're an inherently destructive race who destroy one another.
Yeah.
So the only way to do it is to control us and enslave us. I was on a job the other day where Just Eat have invented a robot delivery man.
Wow.
Now it's a buggy. Really?
Ah, okay.
But you stick your pizza or your kebab in it or whatever it might be that you get from Just Eat, and off he trundles and he just finds his way to your house.
Wow.
Now, obviously, going back to what you learned about at O-level, people listening at home, it is all linked. Going back to all that and Industrial Revolution and stuff, while we were filming this, there was a group of guys sweeping the streets, so like sort of bin men, refuse men, whatever, sweeping all the leaves out the streets. And one of them had to be restrained from attacking the robot. I'm not even joking, this was bizarre.
Oh, wow.
And his reasoning being, it's going to take jobs away from people who work in manual roles.
Yeah, it is.
And he's absolutely right. And in the 19th century, when spinning machines were invented...
Well, it's the spinning jenny. That's that machine of their time. You know?
That's it. And people, Luddites, as they were called, they were led by a guy called Ned Ludd.
They were.
Smashed up all the...
Smashed all the mills and all the spinning stuff, yeah.
Because they were taking their jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, I mean, just from my point of view, and as I was saying to the camera guy I was working with, I mean, I get why a company would invest in this, because this little robot is never going to call in sick, turn up with a hangover, it's never going to nick the pizza, anything, all the things that human beings are susceptible to.
Yeah.
It's never going to do that, but... Do we really want a society where, because most people do jobs that ultimately a robot could probably do one day.
Mm. Well, you're looking at train drivers, you're looking at bus drivers, you're looking at postmen, you're looking at, you know, delivery drivers. Look at Amazon. They can deliver stuff by drone. You know, where's the delivery driver of tomorrow? He's gone.
Yeah. And even stuff like, I was watching a video the other day about nanobots, which you can put inside someone, and cancer cells, which are too minute for even a surgeon with a laser to get out, the nanobot can locate them in your body and destroy them.
Wow, that's Big Hero 6. That's the Disney movie
right
there.
Exactly, exactly.
You know.
And I was watching another video where about robots working in warehouses, and it basically knows how much pressure to apply to a box. Yeah. It'll stack it. It'll work until it runs out of battery. It doesn't need to be paid. It's not on an 8-hour shift. It's not going to have a fag break.
No, it's not. Wow.
I mean, and you see where the companies are coming from, but you also see why people are scared.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a quick question. Do you think that the kids of today realise that they are actually living in history?
No. See, that's such a good question. The thing is, I think the tendency now... And I used to, a few years ago, I've always been really interested in history, but a few years ago, I used to not really watch the news.
Mm.
I'd watch the football at the end, and that would be about it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like on a Saturday night, you're waiting for the news to end, so you watch the match of the day.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is absurd, because I'm living in 50 years, this will be of interest to me, because I will know the whole story, but I'm living through the story now.
Mm.
And I think now is a particularly interesting time
mm.
because at the moment, the West is doing battle with global terrorism. Mm. Also, as, and I don't think this is hyperbole, but as happened in Germany in 1933, somebody has been elected in America.
Ah, yes, he has.
Whose campaign promises were quite overtly racist. And I think, a lot of them.
Yeah, they were slightly racist. Yes, I think you probably could say that. And I think a few of them have already been reneged on. You know, Obamacare's going. Well, not all of it. I'm still waiting to see the tax returns. If I'm elected, I'll show my tax returns. Well, we're still waiting.
Yeah, we're still waiting because you represent one of the biggest companies in the world.
Right there.
And what are those companies famous for? Not paying their tax, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And going bankrupt most of the time. Yeah.
Funnily enough, I think part of his big idea is he wants to award himself and his organisation government contracts,
yeah.
which you're not going to be able to do without being impeached.
No, exactly. I think there's a slight conflict of interest there. Now, it's interesting, Joe, because I speak to my dad. My dad's a massive history fan.
Mm.
In his generation and now in my generation and potentially your generation too, he will always say, well, I know where I was when JFK was shot.
Yeah.
Mine and yours is probably, I know where I was on 9/11.
Yeah, Twin Towers. I remember exactly what it was. I was getting into my nan's car outside school.
Exactly. And for me as well, I know where I was when Diana died.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and those are the seminal moments in the history for us, you know. And you can think back, okay, so what about the generation of my grandparents?
Mm-hmm.
It would have been war being declared.
Yeah.
And their grandparents might have been the day Queen Victoria died.
I think Pearl Harbor is probably one of those.
Oh, it's got to be. It's got to be.
Perhaps not in this country so much.
Oh, I think in America.
But if you're a 70, 80, 90-year-old bloke in America, I expect you remember where you were on
December the 7th, 1941.
Quickly checks notes. Yeah, you didn't, to be fair, I did. Pearl Harbor, what images does that conjure up for you?
For me, Pearl Harbor is our previous generation's sinking of the Belgrano at the Falklands.
Yeah, okay.
Because I've actually had the... I've been lucky enough to go to the Falkland Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually been to Bluff Cove where the ship went down and I've seen all the memorials and all that kind of stuff out there. But you see the footage of these guys covered, you know, in burns and in napalm and all this and trying to get people out of the water. And I can just imagine... Well, I can't imagine what the sights, the sounds, and the more the smells of what was actually going on that morning in Pearl Harbor. You know, you hear stories of people that have survived it.
But it was a Sunday morning, and sort of 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Lots of them were on their way to church.
Mm.
Lots of them were taking the downtime to go to the sort of the cinema that they had on the base and watch films.
Ah.
Basically, the reason the Japanese chose Sunday is because they knew that the fleet weren't doing anything and they were all at anchor.
Okay, of course.
And the idea
was... Other than the three aircraft carriers that were out at sea.
Which they ballsed up massively.
Yeah, absolutely.
The one idea...
That's good intelligence.
The one idea was, whatever we do, we've got to destroy those aircraft carriers because otherwise they can launch aerial assaults on the mainland.
Right there.
So when you come back, it's just like, what did you do? Oh, we blew up this, and this. Sadly, the three aircraft carriers weren't there, and that was basically what allowed the US to continue. And the Japanese failed to do that, and it was a huge turning point in the war, because once the Americans joined in, it's as Churchill famously said, it's not the end, it's not even the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning.
That's right. Absolutely, yeah.
God, he was an absolute soundbite machine, that
one. Yeah, whoever his speechwriter was, I want to know who it was.
When a lady said to him, you're drunk, and he said, I may be drunk, but in the morning, you will still be ugly.
Yes.
I shall be sober.
And we use that today.
Yes, hero. I've lived my life by that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, fantastic man.
Absolutely.
He realised what it meant, because Hitler, being a balmy optimist who basically believed in divine providence, thought, this is brilliant. The Americans are going to enter the war. They'll fight the Japanese. While they're fighting the Japanese, I'll beat the Brits. I'll beat the Russians.
Yeah.
Home for tea. Whereas Churchill sort of went, this is great. Now the Americans won't simply give us economic aid.
Right there.
We're going to get hundreds of thousands of American troops landing in Western Europe, which Hitler, for some reason, didn't seem to realise.
No, exactly. You know, when it came to the D-Day landings and all that kind of stuff, I don't think Hitler was ever prepared for what was actually coming. You know, you look at some of the newer films that have just come out, like, I think it's, is it Fury, the Brad Pitt
the tank film,
movie?
Yeah.
What a fantastic film that is.
Yeah.
And I think that absolutely portrays exactly what those American GIs went through on this side of the Atlantic. it that Hitler didn't expect at all.
Personally, for me, I think the finest war film of all time is Saving Private Ryan.
Very good.
I mean, I just think it's the best war film. From a film point of view, I think it's a great story.
It is very good.
It's also got a fantastic cast.
It does. It has Mr. Hanks. Tom Hanks. You can't go wrong with Mr. Hanks.
Tom Hanks, Matt Damon. Yeah. And, lest we forget, Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel. Oh, my goodness, yes. Vin Diesel.
No film is complete without Vin. You can't get a five-star movie unless Vin's in it.
See, I'm disappointed The Rock wasn't it as well. Then we'd have had the full set. The Rock would be General Pat.
Perhaps The Rock as Hitler.
Oh, really, see, I'd pay to watch that.
Left field piece of color.
I would absolutely pay to watch that.
Dwayne Johnson is Adolf Hitler.
He's gone from the pacifier to the dictator. Yeah, that works for me.
But Saving Private Ryan really portrays the visceral nature.
Yeah, it really does.
Of war. And I mean, that opening scene, arguably the greatest scene in cinema history.
It is.
It's
so
powerful.
When World War II is concerned, yeah, I would agree with you, Saving Private Ryan. For me, I think one of the greatest war films ever is Platoon.
Yes,
It comes to the Vietnam War, you know, you've got Apocalypse Now, which is fantastic, but they were all so off their heads when they filmed it that they probably don't even remember filming it. And Hamburger Hill, those kind of movies were just brilliant for
Full
the
Metal
Vietnam
Jacket's
War.
A great film.
It is
as
another,
well.
That's another great film, yeah.
Moving on to another film. This is a neat segue.
Oh, look at this.
In the Rolling Stones documentary Gimme Shelter,
right,
the film opens with Mick Jagger watching back footage of the Altamont Festival.
Ah.
See, that's how I've linked it.
I see what you've done there.
I've ruined the link, though, by then saying how good the link was.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. Let's balls that up.
So the Altamont Festival, is it a festival you'd heard of?
Do you know what? I'd heard of Woodstock.
Yeah.
I'd heard of Burning Man.
Yes.
But I'd never heard of Altamont. Do you know what? When we look through the story about the Hells Angels, Altamont rings a bell. I don't know it specifically, but the fact that there was Hell's Angels doing security rings a bell somewhere.
Gimme Shelter is a great film. Yeah. There's also a really good Martin Scorsese film, I don't know if it covers it, called Shine a Light.
Okay.
But I personally think the best film about the Rolling Stones is a film called Crossfire Hurricane, which came out about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
I did the premiere and I interviewed the Stones, and it's a brilliant, brilliant film which doesn't paint them as heroes at all.
Oh, really?
It's very honest about them. And Altamont was, I mean, it had Santana, Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead were slated to play there. All the biggest music stars of the day and headlined by the Rolling Stones, whose idea it was.
Right.
Now, the problem that they had is, unlike Woodstock, which was all about, hey, free love, man, was actually Woodstock had the shit organised out of it. Basically, everyone went, if we're going to get a few hundred thousand people together, for God's sake, let's not let it be dangerous.
Absolutely.
Yes, they'll all be stoned off their tits, but it could go wrong.
Yeah.
So they'd be made it incredibly safe. And Woodstock is kind of held up as the emblem of the 60s and free love.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whereas Altamont is remembered for one reason, and that's a murder. So Meredith Hunter was stabbed to death by a Hell's Angel. And there's footage.
Who was actual security at the time?
Who was security. Meredith Hunter, however, who's a bloke, bizarrely, called Meredith, was brandishing a gun.
Ah.
And the Hell's Angel was acquitted on grounds of self-defence.
So I notice we don't find that bit out in your piece. We hear that Meredith Hunter got stabbed to death, but we don't know why.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, that's it. I wanted to do a reveal.
Ah, I see what you're on. And a good reveal it was too.
Thank you. But Meredith Hunter had a gun. So the concert already was at a stage where people could get in with handguns. The Hell's Angels, who...
And this was in San Francisco, was it?
This is just outside San Francisco in Altamont. It's the free love capital
Absolutely.
Of
so
America.
This is not something you'd have expected back then.
The Bay Area in the 60s was free love and artistic creativity.
Absolutely.
And certainly wasn't associated with violence.
No.
I mean, a lot of drug taking.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Every music documentary I've ever made about a band from that era, somebody's on heroin at some point.
Absolutely.
Every single time.
Including the Stones, probably.
Yeah. Oh, well, Keith Richards, famously.
Ah, Mr. Richards.
Heroin and whiskey. That's what will get you to a ripe old age like Keith Richards do. Wow. Well, he's knocking on for 80.
Yeah, he's got to be that. Yeah, he must be, because Mick Jagger's, what, 73 now?
And I mean, he's still alive. God knows how he's still alive. One night of Keith Richards' life would have killed me.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely.
But the Altamont Festival, the Hell's Angels, despite being part of popular culture, are an organised criminal gang.
Wow.
So it's not much different from getting, in the modern era, the Bloods or the Crips to provide security, which you wouldn't do. You'd say, well, no, we're not getting gangsters.
Or getting them both.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Yeah, so you guys, I love the red and I love the blue, but have you ever thought about putting it together and it would make pink? So the Hell's Angels provided security, were given $500 worth of beer, got in lots of fights, there were 3 accidental deaths, 1 murder. Marty Balin from Jefferson Airplane was knocked out.
Oh, right.
At which point the Grateful Dead, who were sort of a psychedelic rock group, decided they wouldn't play sensibly.
Right.
The Stones still went on, and Meredith Hunter was murdered about 15 feet in front of Mick Jagger. So in the footage, Mick Jagger is on stage sort of going, hey guys, can we all calm down, guys, right? Nobody needs to be fighting. And he even says at one point, this guy's got a gun, right? That's not cool. And it's, no, it's not. That's an understatement. Like, imagine that, a Justin Bieber concert.
Unbelievable.
That's what it's remembered for. But obviously...
That's a shame.
It was an end to the 1960s and free love and all that sort of thing. And obviously the next decade would see... Well, the Vietnam War, really.
Vietnam War and glam rock.
Glam rock and the
Can't
beginnings
beat
of
glam rock.
Disco.
Oh, there we are. You see, now we're in my era.
And then, of course, we'd get to the 1980s, which was all fringes.
It was, oh, do you know what?
Pastel-coloured suits.
It was pastel-coloured suits, but pastel-coloured track suits as well. But you only wore the jacket. You don't ever wear the tracksuit jacket. So you'd have a Sergio Tacchini or a Gabici or, oh my word.
With suit trousers.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You'd have your two-tone trousers and your loafers with the tassels on. Mate, we knew how to dress.
That is a shockingly bad look.
It really is. David Brent gone wrong.
The 80s for me has the worst fashion, but arguably the best music.
Absolutely. The girls were in rah-rah skirts and leg warmers to go out. And guys with shaggy perms in the back of their hair.
Oh, God, that's shocking. That's hideous.
It wasn't good. Based on Andy Ridgeley and George Michael look.
One of the worst. The front cover of the Thriller album.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson's hair is horrendous.
It's impeccable. How dare you?
I can almost feel the grease dripping onto the floor where he's lying. Smog.
Yes.
Pea supers.
Yes.
Until I actually did this story today, not that I wrote the script today.
Of course you did.
Pea supers is a term that I knew from my nan talking about pea supers. Is that something that you'd heard of?
Absolutely. My dad was a postman, bless him, for 28 years. So he'd be up at 4 a.m. and he'd come home for his breakfast and he'd go, oh, it's a real pea super out there this morning.
Really?
And I'd be like, do you mean it's foggy? He went, yeah, it's a real pea super.
It's a London thing, isn't it?
Dad, it doesn't look green at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we live just on the outskirts of London. But I always thought it was a Scottish thing.
Oh, really?
That came in off the locks, and they would say, oh, it's a real pea super. You know, and you'd hear that all the time in you know, old St. Trinian's movies.
I wasn't expecting Mrs. Doubtfire to come to the
Mrs.
studio.
Doubtfire's arrived, she's gone now. But yeah, no, I definitely had heard it. And maybe it was from my grandparents and my dad picked it up from them because, you know, he was a teenager and a child in the 50s. So.
And this is the thing about, I think, especially the British, we're very good at just getting on with it.
Absolutely.
That's what we tend to do.
Well, you say that, Joe, but when it comes to the snow, it's the wrong snow on the tracks and it's the wrong leaves.
Don't get me started on leaves on
and
the
Piccadilly
line.
And Piccadilly line at the moment's gone the wrong wheels.
Yes. Now, anyone who doesn't live in London, this won't be a story. Half of the Piccadilly line, so it's about 30-odd trains out of 70-odd, their wheels have split and broken because parts of the Piccadilly line are overground and the leaves on the track have caused the wheels to break. Now, leaves does mean the same thing down here. The things that toddlers kick walking down the street.
Yes, the things that fall off trees.
If a leaf hits you on the head, you're not concussed.
No.
But it's taken out...
But it's split the wheels.
It's split the wheels. And my...
Were they plastic wheels?
I was talking about this the other day. People were saying, oh, well, no, I mean, it must be something they were unprepared for. So unprepared. The Underground has been around for 150 years. Right, we have leaves on the line every year. Why after the first year didn't they go... Probably need some better wheels.
Yeah, wheels are a problem.
Every year just go, shit, the wheels have gone again. Why? Yeah. Of course they have. Because you made them out of plasticine.
Exactly. You know, we've got Tonka toy wheels on. It's crazy.
I once stood at Wandsworth Town Station for 3 hours, freezing cold it was, and the announcer going, due to the adverse weather conditions, there are leaves on the line, and unfortunately the train to London Waterloo is... That's not adverse. If you said... Due to the hurricane, due to the volcano, I'd have gone, yes, okay.
Due to the volcanic cloud that's just come over Wandsworth Town, we can no longer run the trains because it's a real pea super. Yeah. No, well, I must admit, you know, you say that we're kind of, you know, we kind of just get on with it. Mm. Yes, it's the stiff upper lip, the British stiff upper lip that we're renowned for. Yeah. And I think that was that came through because of the war, because people stood up and went, no, you know, you can bomb us all you like, but we're going nowhere.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's, you've dropped a load of snow on us, I'm going to have to stay at home.
It's definitely a generational thing.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, because I certainly feel elements of the sort of the old British era. I feel like I identify more with that. But the piece, because I remember my nan saying, oh, yeah, and we used to go out, oh, it's so thick you couldn't see. What she didn't say was, it killed 12,000 people.
That was your 1950s Cockney almost there.
Oh, almost, yeah. It was so thick you couldn't see. Do you know what? She was quite well spoken. She came from Wood Green in North London. What she never said was, oh, it killed 12,000 people. She just went, oh, it was a bit foggy. Mm. Understatement.
Well, the thing is now, they've just, I think it was last week, they brought out, they said that there was a a smog alert in London because the pollution was so bad.
Really?
Yeah. Because they've got all the counters and, you know, the different things they can measure all the pollution with and stuff now. And I think the pollution level in London is rising again. Yeah. I've noticed in central London that there's more traffic now.
Yes, there
not
is.
Not less since the congestion charge went up. Yeah. Thank you, Boris. But there's more traffic in London. Would you rather have lived in 1950s London with the smog or live in 2016 London with the extortionate prices?
2016, because, I mean, at least those extortionate prices, while they're stressing me out...
They're not giving you TB and emphysema.
But 100,000 people became ill because
of
it.
That's a lot of people.
Stunning. Right, now, one of the things we do on the show is I like to do idioms and where idioms came
idioms.
From. I like Excellent. Language and I like little things. So we did daylight robbery a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
The term daylight robbery comes from a 17th century tax which was imposed by William III, which meant the more windows you had in your house, the higher you were taxed.
Ah.
So people boarded up their windows in order not to pay it. It was seen as a tax on light because in order to save money or not to get stitched up financially, people would have to board up their windows.
Love that.
See?
That's good knowledge, Joe.
This week's idiom is, you know when you say, I wash my hands of something?
Yes.
If there's a right old palaver going on, you say, I wash my hands of this. Do you know where that comes from? You do, you bastard. Go on then.
I used to be an actor.
Yes.
And I directed Jesus Christ Superstar.
Okay.
At an open air theatre.
Can I just say, I was going to credit you with a lot more class then, because I thought you were going to say that it was Shakespearean, but you said Jesus Christ Superstar.
No, I directed Jesus Christ Superstar the musical, and I think that I wash my hands of it comes from Pilate.
It does. It comes from Pontius Pilate.
Washed his hands of the blood when Jesus was put on trial so that they didn't attack him, they attacked Jesus instead.
That's your idiom. So, sorry, mate. So essentially, what happened...
You shouldn't have old people in the studio with you.
But what happened was basically when, obviously, things were erupting around Jesus being crucified, and Pilate's the man who ordered that, he saw that what was happening and that the crowd were getting increasingly angry with him. So he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd so as to symbolically say he was innocent of this man's blood. He washed his hands saying, look, I'm washing off any sin because I had nothing to do with killing Jesus.
Wow.
And because he was quite patently lying, that's now come to mean someone shirking responsibility.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Something that's very often associated with FIFA.
Very.
Bringing it back to sports.
So Sepp Blatter is the pilot of our time. Is that what you're saying?
I think he's considerably worse. On that note, that's it. It's flown by.
Wow.
It's absolutely
it really has.
Whizzed by. Neil, thank you so much for coming
in. Thanks for having me. It's been really good fun.
It's been such a pleasure. I'll get you back on because I sense that we could chat again and again and
absolutely.
Again and again. It's been an absolute pleasure. Make sure you do watch your show. You and I have worked together before and
we
you're
have.
A sports presenter.
I am.
So tell us about your show.
I currently produce and present a show for a small cultural channel called Islam Channel on Sky Channel 806 called Sports Weekly.
Yeah.
It's the first ever show, sports show on the channel. They've never had sport before. So I'm trying to bring something a little bit different. So we're doing features, we're doing news and gossip, the normal stuff at the beginning. And then we do a thing called Sport of the Week where I have a different guest to talk about either a sport or a sporting topic. Then we go behind the scenes. So we take cameras out to different clubs, you know, venues. So far we've been to Lord's Cricket Ground, Chelsea Football Club, these kind of places. Just to show you what happens behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And we show the people that you don't normally see.
Okay.
So like the greenkeepers at Wentworth, we've interviewed them. Because you don't know what they do on a daily basis.
Yeah,
you just see the flags in the holes. And then we do an inspired section. So we're looking at foundations and trusts and looking at the people who are inspiring the sporting generation of tomorrow.
Cool. What's your favourite sport of the week that you've encountered so far?
I had a guy in the studio called Rich Kite, but he's one of the regional development officers for British Weightlifting. And he works in East London with a load of Muslim kids. And his protege is a 17-year-old Muslim girl called Taslima Begum.
Okay.
Who is ranked third in Britain at 17.
Wow.
And is now looking towards Tokyo 2020. Unfortunately, it seems that weightlifting have had their funding pulled. Rich Kite, amazing. So I'm going to go down, we're going to film again, and I'm going to learn how to weightlift. It's on Sky Channel 806, 6:30 every Tuesday evening.
Thank you so much to Neil Reynolds. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Remember, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Very Old News, and please do get in touch. I will see you next week. Oh, I can't do Jagger. How'd you do Mick Jagger? Can everybody stop fighting, please? He's quite close to my David Bowie as well. It's quite hard to separate the two.
And then there was the Green Cross Code Man.
Darth Vader, wasn't it?
Dave Prowse.
Yeah.
Was the Green Cross Code Man. Yeah. And not many people know he was Darth Vader because he was meant to do the voice until he went, I am your father, Luke, because I'm from the West Country. So they got James Earl Jones in instead.
Dave Prowse, do you know that until he saw the first edit of A New Hope, he didn't know he'd been overdubbed. He didn't know that George Lucas had overdubbed
him.
And James Earl Jones has got an incredible voice.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
You sort of think, if he'd have been told 6 months before release, you'd come to terms with it. But Dave Prowse sat there like, come on, kids, we're going to go watch my new film. What the fuck is that?
Not like sounding like one of the Wurzels. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, what a way to find out, though.